Shackleton, Scott, Amundsen. Endurance, Terror, the Fram. The names conjure up 100-year-old images of polar exploration, frozen voyages to the lonely fringes of the planet, where neither cartography nor biology had yet made its mark. Today's satellites trace the night sky, revealing virtually every corner of the map, and even commercial airlines soar over the Arctic en route to destinations in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. But today's guest took a different path to the frozen north. In an age where signs of the pole's past are becoming harder and harder to find, he grabbed a camera and set sail on a voyage long past his illogical expiration date. Welcome back to the Get Lost Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sills, freelance journalist for outlets around the globe. Today's guest is a cinematographer, photographer, and producer who's dedicated his life to documenting the planet's polar regions. He's a veteran of expeditions to Antarctica, Svalbard, Greenland, and the Canadian High Arctic, who started his career as a meteorologist before founding one of the most respected production companies in Africa. Today, he continues to self-fund expeditions to the poles while pursuing creative passions at Rare Fire Studios. His name is Danny Ferreira. He joins us now. Danny, hello, and thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, Joe. Yeah, nice being with you, and thanks for that introduction.
Absolutely, man. Look, it's wonderful to meet you. I know we've chatted on the phone before, but it's our first like face-to-face over Zoom, so it's wonderful to just put a face with the name and actually get to meet you for a second.
Great meeting you, Joe. Nice one.
Dude, I love your story. I think our guests are going to love your story because to me, it's really inspirational. You were on a meteorological expedition to Antarctica. And this is in the 80s. You come back from that and you're still in college and you say, hey, I'm going to found a production company. How does that work? How do you go? Because I know it sounds like, okay, you've got productions. People can look up Urban Brew, which you've gotten rid of now. But you did a production called Ice Dogs, right?
Right.
Was that Rare Fire or Urban Brew?
That was Rare Fire.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's your new thing. So the old gig. So you're in college and you're like, I need a way to pay for college. And you end up decades later with like one of the most successful production companies on the continent. How does that happen?
Yeah, so as a meteorological observer, I got onto the South African National Antarctic Expedition, basically to go to the Antarctic for a year and come back with money to study.
Okay.
That was my intention. I quickly realized that I'm not having worked as a meteorological observer for 3 years, I quickly realized that I'm not a scientist. And I wanted to do more. I wanted to work across the sciences, but not as a scientist. So it was back to university, and it is getting in there and study journalism and geography. And geography with geology and geomorphology and all the various sciences, the geographical, physical sciences.
So rocks and maps and history of the planet rather than like what's presently going on in the atmosphere.
Also what's presently going on in the atmosphere, but not just that. So it's a broader, it's broader. It's kind of mile wide, inch deep, if you know what I'm saying, rather than going down a silo with meteorology, solely meteorology. So So it was coming back, you know, it was basically in the first 6 months of just readapting to social life. You kind of spent what you've made the year before in the Antarctic. Yeah. So I was all set to pay for university with that money. And I got back and it was just a matter of, I had to find money then to continue studying.
Right. Did you burn all of your money that you made in Antarctica just like being around pizza and beer again?
Social friends, just catching up. But also, you know, you've got to buy a motorbike. You need transport. You need to resettle in. And, you know, and when you're in the Antarctic for a year, you can't spend money, right? So you save. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're back and life happens. And you've got to spend that money to just survive. So so basically you've got to look at what resources are available to you, you know, so you've got to study full time. And I was, as a keen photographer, you know, I had that skill. So even in the Antarctic, I was there officially as a meteorologist, but unofficially as a photographer. For me, that's why I was there. We had two fantastic, a color dark room. We had a black and white dark room. And so you could really get on with your photography, and also being there with a lot of physicists and a whole bunch of other scientists. You know, they usually very clever guys, and they get the chemicals in when we did slide development or cibachrome printing or even black and white. They could help to kind of manipulate the chemicals and get more grain or more contrast or whatever. I learned a lot of with these guys. And with all their chemistry knowledge, and that really worked well. So I had that skill that I could then apply. So I started basically as a freelance photographer, shooting everything that moves. Mm-hmm. And then in South Africa, it was also at that time a state of emergency. And then filming getting into the news scene, you know, as a cameraman, shooting news, photographer.
Wow. Yeah. So I didn't even think about that, but you're in South Africa in the early 90s, late 80s with a camera, and you're putting it to use to document this huge social change.
Yeah. You know, it was really kind of mid 80s when it started. So 85, that's kind of when I went back to varsity and university, and that was the opportunity. So it was photographer, video cameraman, And it built from there. So Joe, it was, you know, 2-3 years later, we were a production company of three, and things just picked up. And so I finished my degree, but didn't carry on with any postgraduate studies. I just had to build a company that it was just more work coming. And 27 years later, we were a permanent staff of 400 people. We originated in the excess of 40 hours a week of original content. So that was the kind of, but all kinds of genres, you know, we were a commercial production studio, and that's what we did.
So you're doing not just like news segments, but you're also producing ads and commercials and like, what kind of stuff are you making?
Okay. I must tell you, it was only in the mid 80s that I was a little bit involved with news.
I see. Okay. So that's the start.
That's the start. And very interesting, in the end and during my career and at the end of apartheid, the people that I had access to during that time as a cameraman became my partners in my business, because they knew me from then and they trusted me. And they became the partners in my business. And so we did everything but news. You know, so it was from youth programs to talk shows, game shows, documentaries, drama, soap operas, just everything. Lots of everything.
Yeah. So, entertainment, total entertainment powerhouse.
Absolutely. You know, and that's what we did. And 27 years later, you know, your original partners, unfortunately, I think if you know, it's the way of life. They pass on and they and things change. Corporates buy in, and it just became, you know, it was a candle burning on both ends.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful, but it was not sustainable. And I kind of lost the partners I was doing it with, which I must tell you, isn't just in life, if you've got a partner, the right partner is just a blessing, isn't it? It's not something that is, it's kind of what life bestows it on you. You can't, I think it, you, we think we can choose partners, but I don't think we really choose partners. They
find you. Don't you think you find these people, and I've encountered this a lot lately, where you just find people that you meet and you feel like you've known forever. And then all of a sudden you click and you're in some random foreign country and you guys are a team. And it's as if you've been a team for decades. It's the craziest thing.
It is crazy. I think that's the mystic in life. To me, that's the mystic. It's unexplainable, but I think, you know, it's that seed that you plant in your consciousness. And then all of a sudden you can't question synchronicity because, you know, but things just happen because of this seed in your consciousness, isn't it? Whatever that seed is, but it, as you say, and then you start meeting people, you make relationships, things come across your path, and it just becomes this wonderful experience, life, because of what's in your consciousness, I find. Okay, so
I agree. I agree. Yeah, it's like people talk about manifesting. I don't know if you can really do that, but sometimes I look around and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, maybe there is something to this.
I think it's insane. You know, it must be insane. You know, if you look at early navigators in the Pacific, navigators were on their bellies down in the, what I understand, in the bottom of the vessels, feeling the ocean, and then saying, listen, there's a reef 2 days away, or we've got to go this way, or, you know, and it was like shamanship. So there is something, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's enough of them on the bottom, though, that the treasure hunters are still busy. So maybe somewhere better than others. Listen, I'm glad you brought up seamanship, Danny. Today, we want to talk to you about some seamanship, a sailing adventure that you had. Really an expedition more than an adventure. I think this is so unique and so cool because your past at Urban Brew brings you to this. So you're burnt out in that industry. You've been doing entertainment work. I mean, 40 hours a week is an insane load for any kind of production company. And at some point you say, hey, I've been doing this almost 3 decades. I need to change, right?
Exactly. So, and when that happens, when that realization strikes, and, you know, this is another complexity of life where why must a difficult end and a difficult beginning always overlap? Why is it always at the same time?
It is true. Yeah. You've got to earn it, man.
Give me a break. You know, surely life is you get born, you prepare for it, and then there's an end. But this thing, and it happens more, isn't it? That there's an end and a beginning, and you've got to make both work at that point. So it was the end for me was quite brutal because it was a raw extraction. You know, I had to just rip the plaster off and get on with what I then believe would be a second life. Because ultimately, I wanted to work in the physical sciences as an observer, as a journalist, as a photojournalist. Mm-hmm. And I've done none of that. I got into whatever sells, if commercially television, and do it well. And so that's what you've got to do. You've got to give people what they want, isn't it? Turn the mirror on society, and more they see themselves, the more they want to see themselves. And that was the take. So all of a sudden, moving from a daily dashboard of advertising sales, viewer appreciation indexes, audience ratings, you know, it all of a sudden there's no dashboard. There's no scorecard. And I just realized I needed to get some distance between my immediate reality and myself. I need to just move away.
This is interesting. Then,
you know, so it's a case of time still, there's 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour. You can't make time move faster. So I've got to get distance between me and my immediate reality.
Mm-hmm.
So because of my love of ice and really stayed connected with the Antarctic, and I've been back since 84, I've been back 9 times, you know, and at that point, just before my exit, I did a race, the Scott Amundsen Centennial Race to the South Pole. I got the full rights for that. And that was magical, where we then filmed this race. The series is called Cold Sweat, and it was basically these. I think it was 7 international teams, and they raced from the from the side of one side of the Antarctic to the South Pole.
And is one of them like the Scott team, and one of them's the Amundsen team, or
they were a Norwegian team, but yeah. There were 7 teams. So there was a South African team, Norwegian team, English team. There was a multinational team. There's, you know, a variety of competitors, and we followed the 7 teams. They were in competition to see who can carry on.
So you actually got to go down, and they race, they sail down there, and that's part of the race, and then they get on the land and race too?
No. So we fly in from Cape Town.
Okay.
We fly in and then acclimatize, move up the escarpment, and then the race starts. And then these people, totally unassisted, on skis, ski across the ice cap to the South Pole.
This isn't our episode by the day, everyone. This is just like a captivating side quest. And, you know, we love a side quest. So
So the Norwegians won by, they were at the pole 7 days before the nearest competitor.
Typical.
And typical. I mean, they were so good. They were good at so many levels. But because we were waiting, so we were 2 film teams. I filmed the leaders, and my colleague, he filmed the back. So it was all the pain and suffering was really at the back, and the leaders we had to spin a coin and see who's covering what leg.
Yeah,
and
I
won that one. And we were stuck at the South Pole with a Norwegian team. And one of the team, Harford Sviedel, said, you know, he suggested an expedition, but an old school expedition, a future expedition. Because we sat at the, now it's, you know, 24 hours a day sitting in tents, waiting, weather's bad, and we get to know each other. And we start talking about an old school expedition. A yacht sailed into the Arctic with dogs as land transport. And so it was, to come back to the story we want to talk about, so it was at that departure with my company that I called Harford up and say, Harford, how about we put that expedition together? And then it was basically took us a year to plan the expedition and put everything together. As you can imagine, you know, we had to find a yacht that we can charter. We had to find a pack of dogs. Harford had to get into training the dogs in Norway. Can you imagine going to a kennel owner and try and convince him that he's got to lend his pack of dogs? It's
no,
just insane.
Because they're not. Because if I was the kennel owner, I'd be like, okay, these dogs aren't going to come back. So the idea is born literally in a tent at the South Pole. Everyone knows what they say about fish stories, but this one is true. A while back, I was mountain biking along the Arkansas River near a place called the Big Dam Bridge. In the distance, I could see the afternoon sun falling over Little Rock's lone, round peak. Beside me, I saw a tranquil, rippling pool next to an old railroad bridge, secluded from the rapid river's flow. It was exactly the kind of spot that I'd biked there for. So I hopped off the bike, reached into a backpack, and pulled out a fishing rod. Then I spent the rest of the afternoon watching time slowly roll by in the warm afternoon sun. I even caught a few fish right there in that spot, with my bike laying on the ground and the shallow sand beneath my feet. This is the kind of fishing story that doesn't have a big catch or a record bass attached to it. It's just a peaceful afternoon by the water. The kind that helps you unwind from all of the problems in life. If you listen to this podcast, chances are you've got a nose for adventure yourself. And if that nose leads you to the water, I suggest picking up a tool that can help you enjoy more moments like these. When I travel, I often pack a fishing rod, and though many portable options abound, I like the rods from Wisconsin's St. Croix rods the best. St. Croix's Avid Trek and Triumph travel rods break down into a case that fits in a backpack, or an overhead bin, or behind just about any car seat. They're designed in the USA and made with care from a family-run company that knows some fishing stories don't require any exaggeration. Sometimes, just being on the water is enough. You can learn more about St. Croix's Travel Rods at stcroixrods.com, and you can tell them the Get Lost podcast sent you. Now, back to the show.
And my idea for today's story is born in a tent at the South Pole, naturally. And a year or two later, you say, hey, let's actually make this happen.
Please.
So you need sled dogs. You need a sailing vessel that's capable of going to the Arctic.
Yeah. And, you know, no, Harford doesn't do easy well. So you also suggested you go into the Arctic in late winter because of the beautiful light.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah. This is what a photographer would do is, you know, normal people would go in the Arctic in the summer when it's like passable and stuff. But photographers we're odd birds and we are chasing light. We don't really give a crap about anything else.
Exactly. So February, March, blue season in the Arctic. That's when you want to go. These fantastic views. So it was February that in that year, finding the vessel, getting that, I had to then get build skills because considering the budget, I had to be able to do a watch, get my ticket, you know, so that I can actually do a watch on a sailing vessel. Cut down on crew. I did some cooking courses. So I had to skill up totally away from running a production studio. So it was, I had to skill up. And at the time, we then identified the vessel, 30-meter steel of a bark type, but she's a Ketterig, and in Holland, and chartered her. And her name was Burr at the time. I recently ran into her in Iceland as Beer. So changed the O with a line through to a Y. And I think it's still both means like it's a wind, I think. But Bor is more Norwegian and Beer is more Icelandic. And we found this fantastic vessel. And with
what does it look like?
You know, it's just something from another era, except she's from steel. So it's an old catch rig. Which is very traditional, and nothing like modern ships with winches, and everything is by hand.
And, it's got like these two big masts on it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And triangular sails, but it's not a square rigger at all. But so it was with modern sailing, you can sail her, you know. So she had the skipper, myself, and then what we did, we basically resourced her with mates. So it was an open budget. So, and then mates could join. If you want a berth from Harlingen to Bergen to cross the North Sea, it's going to cost you that. And if you don't, that's fine for whoever's on the vessel because it's just more exclusive, fewer guys on board.
That's cool.
So just that's how everybody helped. If you wanted to be in the expedition, you help fund it, but you're also invited. It's not a money thing. You must have been of the type. You know, so
this is unusual as well, as a lot of our listeners probably not familiar with how expeditions actually work. But you usually have to pay for your place on an expedition, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, you're invited and you basically become a patron of the expedition. So you pay what actual cost. Nobody's making money out of it. And guys just maybe would do Bergen to Bode. Just do the Norwegian coast and hop off and maybe hop back on when we cross the Barents Sea and get to Longyearbyen and join for another 2 weeks there. And, you know, and that was fantastic. And it was also in border than we put the dogs on Norwegian. So sailed up. It was just great, you know, moving.
How many people were on the ship at any given time?
Okay. The Norwegian coast up to border was three and a few mates joined, but they were there for a week or a week away, and so we were never more than four.
Oh wow.
On board. And it was just mooring every night, waking up to that beautiful Norwegian natural wildlife, the sounds, the muted bird sounds in these fantastic landscape with just overrun by mosses, various colors mosses, and it was just spectacular, you know. And I must tell you, I just found it so healing at the time. And then it was crossing the Barents Sea with the dogs, and Harford looked at that, and his hand was on the dogs most of the time, because we also, well, because we're filming it, we knew that if the dogs did not go there all the way and back with a smile on their faces, we won't have a movie. We could never show anything with dogs suffering or that. So
yeah, I know for sure. So, exactly. How difficult was that?
It, you know, these dogs are from hardy stock. There's something in, because it's Greenlandic dogs. So we went with Greenlandic dogs. And interestingly enough, all the polar explorers of significance had Greenland dogs. Amundsen went to Greenland for Greenland dogs before he went to Antarctica and beat Scott to the South Pole. It was always these bigger, not Huskies or Malamutes, it was Greenlandic dogs.
What makes these dogs so special then? It's interesting to me, because I'm thinking about like a Husky dog, but it's not really like an Alaskan Husky like most Americans would think of.
You know, to me, what I've picked up now, having worked with these dogs a couple of times, because I was filming at that time, putting together a documentary on these dogs called Ice Dogs. And there's two parts to these dogs. You know, there's the traditional side, which we filmed in Greenland on another expedition. And this was more the modern take of it, because these are modern outdoor people who wanted to work out more efficient ways of moving with dogs over difficult terrain, frozen terrain. And that was their quest. So, and we there as a working production team with these guys, and these dogs were just amazing at sea. You know how they dealt with it. They, but I must say, much better than what us humans were. You know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no. They quickly dealt with it and then moved on. But when we got to Svalbard, having these dogs as land transport was just magnificence. The freedom. The whole thing on the expedition was silence. You know, so it's not a snow scooter that starts up you in this pristine environment, and all of a sudden a two-stroke snow scooter starts up next to you. That just destroys it. Here you were the dogs, and yeah, they are very excited when before you get going. But the minute you get going, there's silence, and you just hear your skis on the snow surface, and also with the sailing, just the wind in the sails. It was just so special. We had this saying on board that if you can't improve on the silence, don't say anything. So you always think twice before you just speak, you know, because everybody's out there and they've let their guard down, their senses are exposed. You know, we all have built these guards to our senses in the cities, isn't it? The noises, the light, the colors. You've got these senses, but when you in these, like in the Arctic, there are none of these threats, and you can start dropping your these shards, you know, that these protective shards that shields that protect your senses, and you start observing. You see more. You see a deeper blue. You see just it's more white. It's just the snow, and it's and that's what I found. You know, it's just like a rebirth. You get into and you start seeing what you've not seen before. You know, so it's just, and that's what I appreciate of that kind of expedition. What we did. So we had this yacht. We had the dogs, and what we typically would do is we'd drop off a dog team and they'll cross one of the headlands or cross a section of Svalbard, the archipelago. We'll go around, pick them up again, sail to another spot. They'll do something else. We'll spend time in the field with the dogs.
And this is very in the spirit of what an old school exploration, like a geographical exploration mission would have been, I think. And for the listeners, Svalbard is way up in Norway. It's in the Arctic Circle, and it's archipelago, islands, peninsulas, and things. So you're saying that you guys would kind of roll up to an island, drop off teams of dogs and people, let them run around the island, and you would sail around and meet them on the other end, right? While they're trying to look for ways to navigate using dogs as a modern form of transportation.
Exactly. And what will make it so it's configurations, the kind of the hitches being used to make it easier for the dogs, to make it easier for the for the musher. And it's just a modern way of doing these things, and the efficiency that I saw happening out there was just amazing. You know, so it's all in the film, and so we're filming this expedition, and we're out there running along with the dogs, and you know, just trying to get ahead of them at times, and you know, trying to predict where they may go. That truly was a magnificent experience. You know, because you asked about the qualities of these Greenlandic dogs. I think the fact that they are these endurance animals. Mm-hmm. Strong, they are haulers of note. They carry loads that is just unbelievable. You know, with the traditional Inuit hunters that I spent two years later to complete the film, spend a season with them, and I must tell you, 700 kilogram sled, 12 dogs, average speed around 10 kilometers an hour for 4 hours at a time. Rest for an hour, carry on, and they'll do this 3-4 times a day.
You and know, these dogs, like they're happy to do that. They love doing that.
It's unbelievable. I think excitement and enthusiasm is defined by sled dogs, isn't it?
So they just want to run. They know when they're about to go, and they just get excited.
Absolutely, and you've so got to know what you're doing as a musher to not get into a flutter with these mm-hmm. with these howling hounds and then the magic working with these mushers where they've got this cacophony of howls that they then somehow put into a symphony, you know, and they mm-hmm. all work together and they go in a single direction and the energy is in front, but the command is from the back, which always mm-hmm. I just find so amazing that they could actually steer these packs, you know, left and right, and it's just this wild energy, and it's just
how many dogs are on a team?
12 typically in Greenland, but there were two to three dogs with one musher mm-hmm. on skis, and mm-hmm. typically the musher would have the pulk connected, a small little sled connected to him, and the dogs would be up front. So three dogs, musher, and then a pulk. And the musher would draw a pulk. And that was, I think, the most efficient configuration as far as speed and displacement weight would be.
The skill as a human, as a person that grew up in a place where there's no snow skiing in Memphis, where I grew up, absolutely none. It boggles my mind. I've actually had a chance to do something like this briefly on a press trip. I was in Wisconsin in the February or something, and we did a version of this where you only are hooked up to one dog and you're not pulling anything behind you, but you're hooked up to a dog, and it's not a sled dog. It's just like a dog, like someone's dog, you know, from the park. The one I was hooked up to was probably like 30-pound dog. And it pulled me through this meadow. Like I felt like I was in the Millennium Falcon. It was terrifying. So two or three dogs that are like three times that size, I cannot imagine. And then not like just falling and eating shit all the time. I don't know how you as a human could be good at that, but it's amazing.
But you know, these Norwegian guys, they're born on skis, isn't it? I was amazed how they go across various, you know, like blue ice and dogs going in different direction. And he's on skis, you know, and it's just withdrawing a pack behind him. And it's... So it was amazing seeing it. But what amazed me most of these dogs was coming from South Africa, how do they hydrate? Because they don't drink water. Now, how does this even work?
Yeah.
You know, yes, I've seen them and I filmed them chewing into the ice ever so often, taking a bite into soft snow. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the liquid content in snow is so little that they would have to eat with that workload, that they will have to eat snow most of the day or all day long to hydrate sufficiently. And it was only on my return and doing the research in this for ice dogs that you realize it's because of their high fat diet.
Mm.
high fat diet, you know, so with every gram of fat molecule that gets digested, it secretes 1.5 gram of liquid.
You know, interesting. So, yeah. So what are they eating?
Seal meat, you know, so high fat seal meat or whale. And so it's a high fat diet that helps them hydrate. So
it's almost like they're eating, and this is not a great analogy, but like a meaty watermelon.
Right. Must be, but it's more chemical than that, isn't it? I can't elaborate on that because I'm not a scientist in that field, mm-hmm. but it's clearly they hydrate through the fat that goes through their metabolism. Now, then the question is, with us modern people drinking so much water, are we slowing our fat burning metabolism down by drinking water? Should we not be on a high fat diet? And
I don't know. That's a great question to ponder.
Neither do I. But what was curious was that these dogs don't sweat. You know, they cool off through their tongues, and there is no water in the Arctic that they could drink. I mean, they won't drink seawater, of course. I was talking about late winter. So they don't drink water.
These dogs know not to drink seawater, though, like instinctively.
They don't. I never saw these dogs, and I've spent months with them, drinking any water. It's just high-fat diet.
Amazing. I have a question for you about this expedition, because you've left Urban Brew, you've left game shows behind and all entertainment. You were putting your camera use in the field decades after you first went to Antarctica as a college student. And here you are, sort of like, you know, the young lion grew up and he's a wise older lion now, and he's got all the skills he needs. Do you feel more put together in that moment? Do you feel a full circle completeness in your world?
I must say yes to that because, you know, equipment has just gone, it's just become so user-friendly, isn't it? Filming in the Antarctic in 1984 with film and worrying about emulsion cracks in the cold. And if you wind your film on in minus 40, it's a slow wind, and hopefully you'll avoid emulsion cracks. And now with digital, you know, it's just not an issue. And also batteries, how batteries last in the cold now. You know, sure, at that time, we had batteries on our bodies most of the time in the Antarctic. But batteries recently, I mean, they're just so good. I just find if I leave my gear in the same atmosphere. In other words, I don't bring it indoors or outdoors or bring it into my tent, just leave it outside. It lasts for the expedition. It doesn't when you start bringing it in, when you start becoming curious. In your tent, you want to start looking at, you know, your memory card, or you mm-hmm. want to dump your media, start wrangling. I just find that is such an issue if you bring cameras into tents because of the humidity. Humidity goes into the lenses. Lenses freezes when it goes back out. Cameras fogs up. It's the quickest way to write your equipment off, I found. And if you just leave them outside and they can deal with it. So you take your batteries, bring it inside, charge inside, take it out again. And that works.
So you leave the actual body of the camera. Do you put it in like a case or anything?
Just your normal pelly cases, you know, outside.
In a Pelican. And what kind of cameras are you typically using these days?
Okay. I'm a Nikon fan. They nearly lost me, I must tell you, when Sony just like won the race, isn't it? It's just
Sony's are very impressive now. I'm shooting Nikon as well, though. And so this is why I'm especially curious.
Yeah, you know, but my concern was I'm sitting with so much Nikon lenses. That I'm invested in, and it always, you know, cameras are for Christmas and lenses are for life. was my motto. So I spend money on glass, and I have sweet, sweet Nikon glass.
I bet. Yeah, I want to come raid your closet one day. I will fly to Cape Town literally and just come and like, what? Look at all this. It's probably like cool shit from the 80s in there. Who knows?
That's right. You know, so because there's some good glass and there's been good glass around. You know, some of my better lenses are still old manual glass, heavy glass lenses. And I love using them. And with the modern adapters onto modern cameras, you know, Metabone adapters, whatever, it just, it works a charm. So we shot Ice Dogs with mainly the Red Dragon. Mm-hmm. And Red was great. Now I put a nice Zeiss lens on there and it's just magical, you know. So
yeah, that's the go-to like cinema camera, or at least it was then. Maybe still
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. But you know, Ari caught up and Sony again, you know. It's there's so much out there. I feel that, but the reason now with Nikon, with a Z9, and you look at the video, but then again, Sony led with that, isn't it?
Yeah.
The video that you get out of these DSLRs, it's just amazing.
It's really good stuff these days. And for those of you who are like sort of aspiring cinematographers or photographers, or if you're out there making those damn Instagram reels of wildlife with your iPhone, I will hunt you down. Just go buy a damn camera. Like, give yourself the tool that you need to make something beautiful. And I promise you, take a couple of hours. You know, if you were to buy an entry level Nikon Z5 or something, this is less than $1,000. You're going to be able to shoot slow motion video. You'll be able to use the same lenses that we use. You have an adapter, but you could use them. 50 years worth of lenses you could go use. And the next time you're on a beautiful hike, or you're on a road trip, or you're in an area with animals, you'll be able to actually capture these things in a much more compelling way than just whipping out your phone and shooting a grainy video. And as great as phone cameras have, you know, advanced, and as good as they are for certain things and convenient, if you really want to shoot wildlife and landscapes, you just go buy an entry-level camera. It'll change your whole world.
It does. No, absolutely. And it does. You know, so so those were the cameras we used. And I must tell you, shooting wildlife in Svalbard from a yacht was just magnificent. You know, because you don't pursue animals. You are in their realm. They come and investigate you. Polar bear would come up to our vessel and kind of swim around the vessel and kind of investigate, and usually find us boring and realize we're not an opportunity and kind of moves on. But what you get just as a photographer filming from a yacht, because your proximity, if you're on a snowmobile or on foot, for example, and there's bear in vicinity, you try and get away from there as quick as possible. But with a yacht, there's the safety barrier that you can, you know, there's definitely two realms for the wildlife and where you are, and you don't interfere.
It's unlikely a polar bear is going to scale the side of your steel-hulled sailing vessel.
Very unlikely. But also, if there's a pursuit, you could just move off. Mm-hmm. You know, so you just fall off and got magic. You know, there's so much in Svalbard as far as walrus and polar bear and even bird life at that time. Not that much. Usually in summer they come up, but fulmars and gulls, and it was just magical. And of course, foxes, the Arctic fox, which I'm just fascinated by.
So, one of the most beautiful animals in the world, has to be.
Isn't it just a show? And what I try and pursue mostly is white on white. So it is the white Arctic fox on a white, so in a blizzard, Arctic fox. And the only thing that really are these moving pixels, and that would be his fur in the white, or a snowy owl in the Arctic, you know, try and get that in a blizzard, or polar bear. So a bit more interesting weather, you know, so that's the aesthetic I'm after. So go to what the Arctic can give you. And when it's summer, I run away because I'm from South Africa. We have a lot of sunlight. we have warmth, and I'm not going to the Arctic for that. It's for the It's the change of the seasons. It's the change of the elements. It's the interesting time, you know. So it's.
I want to ask you about the actual sailing of the vessel, because that must have been a ride. But before we do that, I want to ask you real quick about shooting that white on white, because I'm fascinated by shots that appear to be monochromatic. Like, they look like they're black and white shots, but they're not. It's full color image that you're looking at. Do you think in the hustle and bustle of cities and towns and even like rural life these days, we're just so consumed by like overstimulation that those shots have a special draw now?
I think so. I think my pursuit now as photography is emptiness, is that it's emptiness, whiteness, and what that does to you emotionally. This, if I put an empty plate in front of you, it's a lot more contemplative than I put a plate with some food on it. Because what the food is on there, that is it. There's nothing more to say about. But empty plate, there's so much more. And with the shields on your senses falling away when you're in that kind of empty white environment, your imagination starts wandering. And there's so much more that you start seeing. And I just feel so much more in the moment as a human being. You know, Joe, for me, is my heaven on earth is the Arctic. That's why, you know, I have great difficulty thinking about Instagram or Facebook or anything when you're there. Because when you're in heaven, you don't really want to tell people you're in heaven. You are content with where you are. It's not about, hey, look at me now, or put a little filter on, you know, make it more dramatic. It's, I'm in heaven. I'm a total contentment.
You know? Yeah, it's the less is more thing. I find this happens a lot in travel. And my partner and I are more and more prone increasingly to do this, but it's even just camping. We just go out camping in some of America's national parks, and they're wonderful national parks.
Oh, they are. Yeah. So I so want to start doing them. Sure. Well, yeah.
Come on. You've got a guide. So, We just go and get lost. We do bring our cameras, but often our phones are on airplane or there's no service. So we just have our Nikons. We run around in the forest or in boulders or in canyons. And, you know, a day or two goes by. We really don't look at anything else. Of course, it's exciting when you get great content and you get home and you want to put it all in a video and a reel and show your friends or story. For me, anyway, I like to do that. I want to inspire people to get out. But yeah, I think it's so important now. And I think that we've got at least a generation, maybe two, that have been overstimulated by technology. And there needs to be a great come down. We all need to just like breathe and chill out, you know?
Exactly.
And, you know, AI is going to replicate all of us anyway. So, you know, that's there'll probably be like AI versions of us hosting AI versions of the show, running AI versions of our social media. You know, meanwhile, we're just like looking around trying to figure out how to make money by running an Airbnb or something.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, disconnecting to connect is really what it's about. And I find, you know, last year I was at the North Pole, because after Svalbard, you know, you want to go further. You want to go into having done the high Arctic, you want to go do the central Arctic and start understanding what that's about and the kind of wildlife that you get to see there. And that's a totally different experience. But then the magic just being out there in the pack ice. I mean, there's a tragedy that is unfolding, and it's also the integrity of the ice and which is sad, and I don't want to really get into that about, you know, really what's happening around us and the fact that we're ignoring it, or we keep on pushing it onto the horizon, but the horizon's catching up with us. We got to the North Pole much quicker. I was on an icebreaker much quicker than what we thought we would, because we hardly encountered any multi-year ice. I actually was convinced that last year, it was 2022, we were going to have a blue ocean event at the North Pole where there wasn't going to be any more ice.
That's almost inconceivable.
It absolutely is inconceivable. So we're chasing ice, but as a disappearing art, you know, it's like it's nature's art. It's out there for us to observe, but it's disappearing. I mean, every year that I go back to Iceland now to some of the glaciers, they've receded, 10 to 70 meters per year. You know, new ice caves open up, which is great, but next year you can't go to the same ice cave because it would have melted away or broken off at least from the glacier face, and it would be ice shards on a distant beach somewhere.
That pace is unreal. I can't believe it's that fast already.
It's quite tragic, isn't it?
You feel like, well, and we'll move on because I don't want to get too bummed out, but do you feel like you're a photographer chasing the last Tasmanian tiger in a metaphorical way? Like, this ice is melting and here you are. And
I do, there's already ice formations that I could go to a specific geographical area and find a very specific ice formation that I can't anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm curious now in December, I'm going down to the Weddell Sea. I'm curious to photograph the platelets under the sea ice to start seeing how that is changing in the Antarctic. And it's certainly changing. There's no argument around that. I'm not a scientist. I'm just observing and just saying what I'm saying, but it's quite tragic for me as an experience. Yeah. And I must say, while there's still ice out there, I'm in transit, so it's trying to get this beautiful, capture these beautiful scenes. And it's just, yeah. So that's why I go out there. And
Danny's done some of that. You guys can look up his book called Out in the Cold. There's an article on Digital Camera World by Beth Nichols about the book. It's an incredible book. And at the end of the show, I want to ask you more about it because I've never really heard of anything done this way. But let's talk a little bit about being in transit and being back on the boar, on the beer. It sounds like a term for like when you get cold, you're like, oh, verse.
It does a bit. Yeah, it does a bit.
So this is a 60-foot long catch. You've got a steel hull, but it's two big masts. I mean, it is something from another time. And if you look at the photos of this journey, it looks like you were there in the 1800s. I mean, it's fully wild. I'm like, where is Shackleton? He's on this boat. So tell us about just sailing around Svalbard. You're in the Barents Sea. You're in some pretty rough weather. What's your knowledge of sailing at this point, and how do you handle it? I mean, you trained to be on watch. Did you have to put it to use?
Yes, definitely. But we've had, of course, if you're in that area, you need the experience. So the skipper that came with the yacht had the experience, and then there was a first mate as well with local knowledge that we picked up in Namibian. So whenever I'm on an expedition, there's got to be people that's responsible for safety and security. Mm-hmm. And because as a photographer, you are destined for disaster because you always want to spend that little bit longer in this kind of light or go a little bit closer, and you need someone to make the health and safety call.
Oh, yeah.
And I obey. We can talk about ethics later, but they've got the veto. They call it now. We're going to go down this ridge now, because if we don't leave now, it will be dark before we get to the bottom, and it would be life-threatening. So I always have that. And, yes, we had that in place. So although I was an absolute rookie, I could assist on watches. I never commanded a watch. So I never commanded the vessel on my own. Wouldn't dream of doing, now, just you need local knowledge. We've had that, in weather, the rigging would freeze up and be iced. And it would look like when the sun comes out again, look like a illuminated Christmas tree decoration. It was just like iced.
It's beautiful. I'm sure you wanted to grab your camera, but that probably puts you in a pretty weird situation from a sailing perspective. It's not safe.
It does, because ropes are iced up, sails are iced up, and then you've got to start working on getting that all defrosted and get chip the ice off the vessel. And you can imagine,
How do you do that? How do you defrost lines that are up in the air like that?
it was mainly so you'll work your way towards Longyearbyen, and there's it's a little settlement, and they would have steam available to you. So there's there were services that we could get to, but
okay.
Out there, what would be chopping away, and to get some of your halyards and lines available to you and sails, it would be just be chipping away. And obviously, weather also gets tired, and when the sun comes out again, it does melt, and it runs. So we never had real big trouble because we avoided it. Mm-hmm. We'll hide in coves and in fjords from the weather, and that was just magic.
Did you have some advantages that maybe they wouldn't have had 100, 200 years ago? Like, did you have a radar so you could see storms or anything? Did you have things like that?
Of course, no. We had all the mod cons, at our, and also ice charts that you could download. That's available. Satellite ice charts. You see what weather? Yeah, I mean now it's way better than what we used to have. And also, quite frankly, there's a Coast Guard going around the Svalbard, that one can connect with and get to know what the conditions are like.
All right. So you've got the radio. If all else fails, you got VHF.
And satellite phone. Yeah. So it's, no, you can't even compare. I mean, they've broke the mold on those men of the past. Geez, what they must have gone through is crazy. So we just had it. We just had to be responsible.
So how far did you end up sailing?
82 degrees north, so above Svalbard, kind of there's a little village. So New Ålesund was our last port or a little town that we like a scientific settlement mm-hmm. that we attended to, and then we went out there. But it wasn't further than 82 degrees. 82 was our most northern point.
Do you feel like when you got to 82, when you're up there, is it mission accomplished, or are you like, okay, we're only halfway there because we still got to get these dogs over to Greenland?
Those dogs could never go to Greenland. Once a dog has left Greenland, can't go back it could contaminate the packs. It wasn't the same dogs. It was a totally different. So it was this. It was two different expeditions.
Yeah. Okay.
At the same time of the year, and then edited together as if at the same time.
Talking about ice dogs, which you guys can look up online. I assume you can stream it somewhere. I think I saw that when I was researching it. It's streamable.
Right.
This is so interesting to me, and it kind of leads in towards the tail end of the show, because you've spent 2 years filming Ice Dogs. And we mentioned earlier Instagram and things like that, and how nowadays it's easy to run out and maybe you're off the grid for 4 or 5 days, but you run back and boom, 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 boom. You edit on your phone now, and you've got a reel, and you throw it up on Instagram, and you can only have 90 seconds.
Right.
You only get 90 seconds. But you specialize in long-form storytelling, and when you look at clips from Ice Dogs, you see that the environment has room to breathe. The cinematography shows the landscape. It's not quick hit, boom, 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 boom. You're immersed in that. So what is your take now on like the popularity of short form video? Is it good? Is it bad? What do you think about it all?
I must tell you, I think there's good in both. There's good in both. I lived in an era where in the late 80s, where the BBC would do a half an hour documentary on a desert storm. Mm-hmm. You'll cut to CNN and they'll do it in 3 minutes, and you'll get equal amount of information out of that. It's how you do your short form, isn't it? So, and I think that short form was the, how I think channels like CNN at that time gained their popularity, because mm-hmm. it's a loaded 3 minutes. It's loaded, and you get the information and you can just move on, because that's the time you had, isn't it? Rather than sitting to a 30 or 20 minute documentary on BBC at that time.
Okay. This is great perspective. I didn't even think about it this way, but yeah, it's not like TikTok or Instagram invented short form video. They just made it accessible.
Exactly. And it's how you do it. And that's, it's just, if you can just get that emotion, and you don't have to sit 30 minutes to get to that emotion. But for me was my view after I've been in commercial television, I just wanted to do a documentary that is slow and can breathe, and that I can show to a mate in a art gallery somewhere, and he can just go, wow. And that's why I did it. One, yeah. If I can get one wow out of that, it would have been enough for me, because I did it for myself. It was a healing process. And yes, there was two, three other cameramen that also shot in it at times. Sven Adling is a Norwegian cameraman that did a huge amount of work. Derek White was another friend. These are all friends that joined and just all clubbed in and shot. Nobody got paid to do it. You know,
that's fantastic. I mean, yeah. It's not if you're counting, if you're trying to pay the bills, but if you're just buddies and you don't need the cash to go out and actually do a passion project, is a really different deal.
Totally. And this was, and I think we are so much better if we can do passion projects. You know, what isn't about a screaming commissioning editor on the other side of a phone and, you know, and telling us how they've got to get audiences, and they just doing it for yourself. It was a big privilege. Let me just put it that way. It is, it's not sustainable, but it's great. And I've kind of kept that up, you know, to start just shoot what I wanted to shoot, put it together. Like the two books I recently launched was just, it's about these expeditions, and with every expedition come photographs and a story, because to me, every expedition has three pillars. You know, it's who you're with what you're doing it, and where you are. Those are the three pillars. And it's always about the – so quickly, you know, I see people traveling, and they don't care where their fellow – who their fellow travelers are. It's all about getting a shot or – and I was like, you've got to slow down, because when you're going to go back, you're only going to tell stories about this interesting lady you met from Boston. And Anita is fantastic, and she's possibly one of the best explorers I've had the privilege of being with on a variety of expeditions, you know, and journeys with her, whether it's Central Arctic on the Captain Klepnikov icebreaker or in Namibia. And it's just someone that I met and like-minded. And so it's who you're with, where you are, and with what. So if I'm in the Antarctic and I follow skiers racing to the South Pole, and I'm with a team of Icelandic MacGyver type men who can fix this big ass Toyota Arctic trucks in the middle of the Antarctic with, you know, weld a high lift jack with batteries, using batteries, and weld a high lift jack into the chassis of a Hilux Toyota. I was just a blown away. How is this even possible? If it had happened to me, I would have just been stuck and asked for an evacuation. But having these guys, so it's them, who they are, their skills. It's broad. I mean, I've never seen people with such a broad skill set. Then these effectively drivers, mechanics, software engineers on these vehicles that I was, and this is all one person I'm talking about. You know,
so it's funny because, and in a lot of ways, the destinations are the backdrop to the people.
Totally.
It's just how humans are made, I think.
Shows you the man, shows you the person, shows you the woman.
And
the emptier the environment, the more obvious the individuals become.
I can imagine that, because there's just so much fewer people and so many different skill sets at play, even within one person. Denny, as we kind of wrap up here, a couple of questions. First, talk to me about your books. The one that I'm familiar with is Out in the Cold, and it's sort of a compilation of a lot of the shots that you acquired while filming Ice Dogs, I think. But this is a really cool book. It's sort of a handmade coffee table book, but it's really, really special. Can you tell people about it? Like, what makes it special?
You know, I wanted to get into what's the purpose of filming, shooting stills if you're not going to publish it, right? You've got to do something with it. And again, the same attitude. And I wanted to do something different. And I wanted my book, which turned out to be two volumes in a box set, to be more comfortable in an art gallery than what it is in a library.
Mm-hmm.
So the two books that I've recently launched is it's a box set of two volumes, North and South.
Mm.
Now, what makes them unique and I believe a world first is they both carry a stamp and a certification that that happened at the North Pole and at the South Pole. So South was overstamped and certified at the South Pole, and North carries a stamp that was certified and stamped at the North Pole. So these books.
How do you do that? How do you arrange that? And it can't be that many that you print if you're doing that.
I've only done 100, so it's 100 box sets.
Mm-hmm.
As collector's items, and all, you know, got the original seal, been to the pole, the respective poles. And then I teamed up with these fantastic publishers in London. And I was directed, I was like looking for the right people, people that get anxious when the grain of the paper are used wrongly.
Oh my God, yes, okay.
In a print. And so Hurtwood does that. They are those people, mm-hmm. where they take in your layout and your photographs and your text, and they start molding it into like a handmade project. And then it goes to book binders and printers in Ludlow that does it by hand.
God. So these 100 books are made meticulously.
It has taken not less than 12 months to be put together. When I went to visit these people, like, but come on, you know, I did not realize it was so intensely handmade.
Yeah. To me, they look like middle-aged monks too. They're like, you know, writing with an ink pen and they're dipping it in, you know, in the ink thing. It's like almost that level though.
Absolutely. You know, I must tell you, maybe not at that level, but I was blown away to see how handmade this was. So these box sets are now, each book is three expeditions south and three expeditions north. So it's this physical engagement. But it is, to me, you know, like you giving me a moment to tell you about my story is this, it's such, there's so much power in that. There's so much weight in someone giving someone a moment. And I wanted only to do 100 volumes.
Hmm.
Someone to give me a moment to page through my book as a contemplative journey, just to be there. And it's more empty than what it is full, this book. So if it's a polar bear on white over a double page spread, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And with anecdotes, if each chapter would end with learnings, because in my conversation today, I've had some learnings from you. You made some observations, which I think, geez, that's genius. And I would make notes of that. So after every expedition, I would have field notes, and I'll write those. I published those field notes in these books of what was the learning, you know?
Yeah.
What I saw on a dashboard of an Arctic truck, or what I saw in the cockpit of a sailing vessel that a captain thought it's important for you to know that if you open it, you should shut it. If you break it, you should fix it. And it's,
I think this is important. And it harkens back to an episode we cut a few years ago in the Peruvian Amazon, where Matthew McConaughey comes on and talks about, journaling and the power of writing things down. And his book at the time was New Green Lights, and it was all a compilation of just notes that he had written over decades. He dug out and, you know, compiled this book with it. But I think that's so important. And to talk about when you give people a moment, I think also to address aspiring photographers in the audience, there's another power that you gain when you have just an entry level camera. And we're not sponsored by any camera company. Like, I'd love that, but we're not. If you have these high quality photos, you can then print a book. It doesn't have to be made in London and handcrafted by, you know, meticulous paper smiths, but you can go to Shutterfly and you can order for about $100-$150 a really nice flat fold coffee table book. And if you do that, you can sit around with your friends and share this in a bar or a pub or at a dinner or at a coffee shop, because it's much more tactile and real than just flipping through your cell phone and showing people, you know, I don't mind looking at people's phone pictures. I think photos are interesting, but it can get old. Whereas if you have a book and you hand it someone and they ask you questions based on this and this and this, this is a much more engaging experience. Plus, you've got something physical that, you know, generations of your family can hopefully hold on to and at least remember you when you were gone, you know?
Exactly. You know, it's like I've got a photograph that I treasure from my grandfather that's on a camel in front of the pyramids in his RAF uniform as a flight crew during the Second World War. And I'd love to know the story. And there's no way. I just found it in his logbook, and I know he flew around Egypt, the old DC-3 Dakota. And it's like, what's the story? So I think you've got to publish because you're going to die. You've got to.
Yeah. And now you have that, and maybe you don't know the story, but there's a myth around that photo now. And you probably want to go to Egypt and stand there and like do, recreate that. You want to fly a Dakota around. And I mean, why not, you know?
Yeah. No, totally.
This one moment. Last question I have for you, Denny, is when we go back to this trip to get distance from your old job to enter your new life, when you close your eyes and think about this expedition with the dogs and the ship and everything you did up in Norway, what's the one moment that really comes back?
Wow. The one moment, the one moment was when we moored onto drift ice. So we threw our lines out and we put ice screws in and we moored against drift ice. That was, I think, the most one. Well, it's not just a moment. I mean, I can tell you that evening we heard like sounds like submarine sounds down now when we were in our bunks, heard these submarine sounds. And I was like, what can this be? You know, it's just heard these sounds, and we moored and we were out in this fjord, moored against this piece of ice. And then it turned out to be bearded seal, the mating call of a bearded seal. And you could only hear it because you are submerged. You know, mm-hmm. you are below the borderline, and you've just got this metal hole between you and the water, and it penetrated. We could hear it. It was mm-hmm. fascinating. So I think those are the magic moments. And of course, when you're above the surface, when you're going out on deck, you can't hear a thing. And I think when you start experiencing that, which was you could not expect that. Yeah. And you just found this out, and you next day start calling and say, "What could the sound be?" And talk to the Coast Guard friends on the Coast Guard to say, because some of the guys on board, Norwegian guys had friends on the Coast Guard, say, what could this be? And then it would come back because you want to know if there's submarine activity in the area or something.
Yeah, no, if one's going to pop up underneath you and suddenly you're airborne.
Exactly. You know, so I think that was to me the most special moment, if I could say that. So totally self-indulgent moment. Yeah.
It's important, though. I think that's really cool. The one thing I'm going to take away from your journey is don't speak unless you can improve on the silence.
That's it.
It'd be a good tattoo for somebody out there. But Danny, I think you've documented the polar region so beautifully and so wonderfully in a way that few others have. I think your experience there is amazing. Going from film into the digital age is absolutely amazing to get your perspective on. And I know that you're going to continue to do it. So it's my honor to have you on the show. And I encourage you guys to connect with Danny. You can go look at his website, DannyFerreira.com. We'll tag you on Instagram. The show's Instagram at Get Lost Podcast. It's the best way to like connect to us, message us and stuff. But man, thank you so much for sharing this amazing journey with us.
Yeah, and thanks for giving me your time. I much appreciate it.
It goes both ways.
The Get Lost Podcast is a production of Sold Outside Exploration Company. Follow us on Instagram at Get Lost Podcast for giveaways and info on new shows. Make sure to leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends.